Hello, welcome back to Night White Skies. Today is August 2nd, 2020, and this month marks the 4-year anniversary of Night White Skies. Aw, thank you. That's so kind of all of you. I do have a bit of an announcement. I'll be releasing another 4 or 5 of these through August and September before taking a month or two off to prepare for something new by the new year. I may have been doing these podcasts for about 4 years, but since more or less year one, I've been toying with the idea of somehow bringing a visual component to the program, since design is obviously such a big part of all of this. But that's, of course, easier said than done. But I think now I have something figured out that I think will be quite interesting. It still leaves a lot to be flushed out, but somehow by saying this out loud on the program, it means I actually have to do it. So that's part of the ploy here. But don't worry, if you do enjoy the sort of audio-only part of the podcast, that's still going to be available. But there is going to be something bigger happening at the same time. And I do promise you that it's more than just a camera videotaping me and a guest having a conversation. But that's all I'll say for now, so more on that soon. Today, however, is a conversation with Holly Jean Buck, and we're discussing her book, After Geoengineering: Climate Tragedy, Repair, and Restoration. I think for many of us that like to think that we're working in at least the general wheelhouse of climate change, that we still don't have a firm grasp of what geoengineering actually entails. For most of us, it's a singular black box technology that will either help our current situation or make all of it much worse. It's often portrayed as a technology more so than policy or even design. It's characterized as a singular action rather than a series of discrete temporal actions that are rather wide-ranging in their approach. It's also often assumed to be already defined, waiting to be executed, which it's not. In After Geoengineering, Holly Buck brings into focus the importance of asking what we as inhabitants of Earth are looking for on the back end of these climate remediation projects. What are we working towards, and who has been a part of these discussions? The book and the discussions here raise questions for the need of participatory design. The book highlights the upcoming struggle in preparing for infrastructure-scale projects that, if successful, will be temporary in some cases. How do we restructure our value systems in order to work collectively at such a global scale? Holly Jean Buck is an assistant professor of environment and sustainability at the University of Buffalo in New York. She researches how communities can be involved in design of emerging environmental technologies and works at the interface of geography, social science, and design. Her diverse research interests include agroecology and carbon farming, new energy infrastructures and technologies, artificial intelligence, and ecological restoration. She has written on climate engineering, including humanitarian approaches, gender considerations, and human rights issues, and is the author of After Geoengineering: Climate Tragedy, Repair, and Restoration from Verso Books. Hope you enjoy the program, and as usual, a big thank you to the Graham Foundation in Chicago for supporting this program. And until next time, take care. Talk soon. Holly, thanks for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here.
I want to kind of jump into the book before we get into kind of the details about geoengineering, which take up a chunk of the book. But you say, which I found really interesting about it, and as the title says, After Geoengineering, is that geoengineering really must be kind of wrestled out of the realm of technology. Like, we see it as a kind of technology, and in many ways, for a lot of people, a kind of black box, meaning we don't really even understand what that means. And for the most part, because of that, we see it as something that only experts are kind of permitted to be involved in, you say, and instead see it as a series of kind of projects and programs and practices that allow us as a kind of society, a larger global society, to kind of actually shape it in meaningful ways. And I'm thinking about, so this idea of After Geoengineering is the idea of not only simply stopping the production of so much CO2, but actually the actual removal of CO2 from the environment. And then actually just kind of questioning, you know, what then? Like, what then in terms of what we do from that? How do we live with that? How do we maintain that? And I was thinking of, when you said that, I was thinking of Oliver Morton has a book, Planet Remade. He was on this program a couple years back. And either he talks about it or he's referring to somebody else who talks about the difference between pulling and pushing, you know, sort of like pushing people to make change versus pulling them based on incentives that are much more intriguing. And it seems to me like in many ways, this project that you, of the book is this, is the actual idea of bringing people forward, like actually thinking about where we want to be after this, or even during this. And so I'm wondering, how do you, with your background, how that must be quite a struggle, I would imagine, in many ways, since geoengineering is so often associated as a tech. And quite frankly, as you say in the book, it's a tech that people don't really even understand, even the scientists themselves. So how do you struggle both in terms of articulating this or actually even talking with people about where we go with geoengineering beyond its sort of tech-specific initiatives?
Yeah, well, I think we have a broader challenge in that we're often in this position of reacting to new technologies or new infrastructures or new projects after they've been conceived of and announced and are on their road to implementation. Or maybe it's something like, you know, what we've seen with a lot of tech platforms and that have changed our lives. We didn't anticipate what happened, you know, with our democracy or other domains with Twitter, Facebook, all of these things. You know, they were just invented. People weren't really part of the conversation about shaping them, and here they are. And that's where we tend to be with a lot of things. I think geoengineering is in a similar dynamic where there's a sense that people are proposing these ideas and there's like a learned reactive posture. So I think it's tricky to get out of that because we don't really have institutions for participatory design. I'm thinking about this because I grew up in this planned community called Columbia, Maryland, and I'm visiting there, my parents' household. And it's just like you go out the street and everything has been planned for you, these neighborhoods, these villages, these pathways. And it's, in some ways, it's much more pleasant than, you know, the alternative forms of suburban sprawl. But you definitely feel like somebody had a vision and you're living in their vision. You know, so what does an institution for participatory design on all these different spatial scales look like, from a neighborhood community scale to something like the planet? I mean, we're just right now evolving the vocabulary and I think the demand for that.
In some ways, even before we get into that in more detail, there's an aspect of geoengineering, the way in which you describe it, that I think helps very, very much for people to sort of see it not as a corrective mechanism to be executed just to sort of solve a problem, but instead, maybe if you could explain just maybe kind of shortly or quickly this idea of the difference between tying geoengineering to the idea of actually stopping future emissions, the idea of sequestering or capturing new or old emissions from the past, and then going forward. That's not such a clear cut. Like when we think of geoengineering, I think people think of simply spraying chemicals in the air. They think of maybe putting various metals into the ocean to produce blooms and create sinks. They think of these sort of large one-shot deals, meaning you do it, either you destroy the earth because you got your calculation wrong, or it doesn't work and you have some sort of catastrophic byproduct that no one had thought about. But instead, it's a much more nuanced, continuous aggregation of small moves.
Yeah, I think that it's helpful to think about solar geoengineering and carbon removal separately, usually, but both of them would be a long-term program. So solar geoengineering, which is most generally thought of in terms of stratospheric aerosols or putting particles into the stratosphere to reflect incoming sunlight, which would have a global effect of cooling the planet, that's a program that would need to be maintained over at least decades and probably centuries. It would need to be maintained until mitigation and carbon removal had been implemented and greenhouse gas concentrations were lessening. So, I mean, what other project has the world started, you know, that goes on for centuries, right? It really demands a different temporality of thinking of it. And especially in terms of thinking about being able to end it at some point. Carbon removal too would be basically building an infrastructure on the scale of the existing fossil fuel industry, but for putting carbon back underground, and not just scaling up that infrastructure, which people are, you know, really thinking about how to do, but eventually phasing it out as well. And this would be kind of ideally an intentional move. I mean, we weren't intentional when we built out, you know, all the fossil fuel injection wells and extraction wells and pipelines and refineries and all of that. It just kind of spiraled and happened, driven by capital. But what if we could plan an industry for carbon removal that ramps up, removes a lot of carbon, stabilizes greenhouse gas concentrations, and eventually is made obsolete as part of the design? I mean, I know that that probably sounds like crazy to listeners, but you have to understand that right now, it's kind of understood in the scientific community and in the policy community that there's a need for some level of carbon removal. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says that curbing warming to 1.5 degrees would rely on removing between 100 and 1,000 gigatons of carbon dioxide. So a gigaton is a billion tons. So the current emissions are about 40 gigatons of CO2, closer to 50 if you also include other greenhouse gases per year. So this is already assumed, you know, that there will be some kind of infrastructure built out. Whether it will or not, I have no idea, but you can see it coming out in policy plans and documents, including the House Committee's plan on the climate crisis. This is a U.S. congressional document that came out in the last month. Joe Biden, the Democratic candidate, also has R&D into carbon removal in his plan, because people are reading the science and realizing that we're in some sense already banking on some level of implementation of this technology.
Yeah, it seems like a really interesting conversation to be having in terms of timescales. I mean, at one point you're having a timescale in which you're saying this is going to take a century or more to implement and to work. But at the same time, keep in mind, if we do this correctly, we're going to shut it down. And so, of course, that's not unusual, because if you can think back to any industry that was occurring 150 years ago, it's unlikely it's still happening today anyway, but to some degree. So it's in the front end, we consciously know that to be the case, but it's an interesting thing to have to sort of acknowledge that its success in some ways requires the removal of the industry you're telling people requires immense expense and scientific breakthrough, really.
Yeah, but I think of it as kind of a remediation program, or, you know, a waste disposal program, that if you stop producing the waste, then you don't need the waste disposal service anymore. I think that's probably the most helpful way to think about it.
Yeah, go on.
No, I just should make clear that right now there's a lot of different visions collapsed within some of these terms. So, right, we have these net zero goals. Net zero usually means some amount of remaining continual positive emissions that are balanced by some amount of negative emissions. And it's kind of envisioned that the energy future will look like that for, I don't know, at least the rest of the century, right? Some amount of fossil fuels compensated by some amount of removals. So in that case, that's a permanent vision. So then there's this vision also that is kind of a bridge to this larger scale of carbon removal, which is really just waste disposal underground. And right now it's really convenient to talk about these things under one umbrella when it comes to policy, because you can get a lot more people on board. You can have fossil fuel industry groups who see this as a way to continue production throughout the rest of the century, together with environmentalists who really would prefer to end the fossil fuel industry, but they can work together as long as the concept is kind of broad and confused between these two different things. So there's a lot of interesting temporality questions in there as well. And I think that as the conversation continues in the next couple of years, some of those tensions will be closer to the surface. Hmm.
Yeah, because you mentioned in the book, I think a couple of some of the people you speak to use that idea of the waste removal, like thinking of this as a kind of as sanitation, as waste removal in the way we conduct ourselves now, at least in relationship to carbon sequestering. And so one of the things you point to that is important, I think this goes back to that first question of how to kind of wrap our heads around the scale and in ways messaging that's required for something like this. And you talk about a geoengineering as a type of infrastructure, and the fact that, like, whether it's the scale of it, the cost of it, but also that kind of messaging. And I think you make the examples of, say, levees on our floodplains are for security, or the idea of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon are about abundance. And when you start having these sort of messagings tied to these sort of infrastructure projects, it allows for people to engage them. And in many ways, the thing that's also with the infrastructure is, I think you point to the fact that it's an industrial scale project. So even though we like the idea of local, meaning it has a kind of romantic possibility to it, that it's, you know, grow your own vegetables or live locally, these sort of local actions, that, and really for this, like, as you mentioned, the kind of quantity of CO2 that needs to be removed can only really occur at a kind of industrial scale mechanism of production. But through some of the examples you talk to, it also raises the question too of scale. Like, it doesn't also mean that it has to be visual, like our national highways in the United States or the Hoover Dam. Like, the scale and the idea of industrialization of its conditioning aren't one in the same. They actually can deviate from each other, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of design choices that can be made about the scale. And some of them are actually related to the different technological processes themselves. So there's different forms of direct air capture that work in different ways. And one of them implies, a much larger scale facility. And the other one implies a more distributed modular design. And yeah. I'm not quite having the scientific background to explain the nuances of that. But it's very interesting that, you know, right now it's still kind of on the drawing board, which will be the most efficient and effective. And there's room to, like, make choices based on values too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, because in a weird way, it's one of those questions that keeps popping up that I think I've wrote in the margins more than once, which is, like, what scale is geoengineering? And it came up in multiple times, because at some point it seemed like it was this, you know, when you're talking about aerosols, or you're talking about the sort of solar version, you know, of particulates in the air, you are talking about this regional large scale conditioning. And at other times when you're talking about the sequestering of carbon in these sort of smaller moments on the sides of property, like, all of a sudden it becomes something that's geoengineering. It sometimes feels like it's the size of a detached garage. And at other times, geoengineering seems like it's the scale of Vermont. And, you know, somehow trying to reconcile that is intriguing, but I can imagine also quite dizzying for others to grasp their heads around, including myself.
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of different scales. I think solar geoengineering is kind of unique in this way when it comes to stratospheric aerosols, because that is the one thing that really is planetary, just because if you put these particles into the stratosphere, they're going to circulate around the globe for a year or 2 years possibly, and before they fall down again. So that comes with its own kind of dimensions. But most of the carbon removal things, I mean, they're going to be implemented in particular places and have relationships with, you know, landscapes and communities and so forth.
It seems like, for instance, when you're reading through the book, and obviously, as you just mentioned, with any, like, with the Green New Deal or Joe Biden's platform or the Paris Accord, like at some point, there's always a kind of byline of cost. You know, there's always a kind of financial side to this, which is how do you motivate financially for these things to occur? And obviously, that's because we're working in a kind of a capitalistic society. These are our mechanisms for thinking about value. That's how we place value on things, is generally through monetary kind of numbering. And there seems to be within the book this kind of various conversations in which you're talking to some entrepreneurs who have, you know, who in some ways you can't help but think that this is a sort of I think you talk about it as a green capitalism, meaning sort of shifting our focus away from the capitalism of fossil fuel corporations that are exploiting. And now we're looking at, say, tech companies in the Silicon Valley, and it's sort of like a greenwashing of goodness, but still is a kind of undercurrent mechanism still there. And there are a couple of moments in which we see other opportunities. There's one, this idea of gifting, in which you have to sort of change this logic of it being a financial good for yourself to this idea of gifting to a next generation. But you also have these ideas of where we see innovation. And I think when we tie it to a kind of a capitalistic approach, you know, it's about innovation is a kind of tech that solves a problem or allows us to do something better. And you have a conversation here with a couple of different people, one of them, which is the idea of innovation instead, the sort of mindset of degrowth, in which innovation is directed towards new organizations or principles that are social and technological arrangements, not necessarily new widgets and production systems, but instead ways in which we organize our, in a way, lifestyles. And so this seems, I mean, this is a very, again, I'm having a hard time pinpointing really tight questions, almost because so much of this stuff is so open-ended for good reasons. But in a way, as we shift from a kind of capitalistic monetary system that often is tied to a better horse, and now thinking about new mechanisms of value that are tied more to organization, how do we, that seems like as much as geoengineering as a strategy is going to take generations, I almost wonder if simply shifting our values of or saying like how do we value something is also necessary for such a large move to occur. It's not simply a technological change, it's actually a societal shift in how we claim to have value in something.
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting because I've been interviewing people recently on how experts mainly on how they see the scale up of carbon capture, utilization, and storage. And people almost every respondent has said, you know, the big challenges aren't technological at this point. We know how to do this. Where we really need the creativity and innovation is in the social organization and the policy space. People are fairly confident in a lot of the tech at this point, but they have no idea how to get it out there, you know, at scale. I think that there's a lot of energy too in Silicon Valley because a lot of people who have been working in tech and made a lot of money in tech are now frustrated with that field and what's going on, what they're doing with their lives basically, and want to get into this climate and carbon space, but they're bringing with them, you know, a set of past experiences and a way of looking at problems so that when they think about, you know, organizations, they might think in terms of building platforms that connect people and that kind of thinking, which I do think there's a need and a role for that. But it would be nice to have other currents informing this idea of, you know, what social entrepreneurship means or what organization building means.
Yeah, it seems like at a lot of times we need to make plans in a kind of linear fashion. Like we think at a kind of current condition, X, Y, and Z are going to occur, and we need to sort of implement A, B, and C to contradict that. And how do we solve things like this idea of redirecting value or finding mechanisms in which we can place value beyond the kind of monetary capitalistic society and still have a living, like still be able to rent an apartment and raise a family? I mean, we can value things, but that doesn't always mean that it comes with a kind of monetary benefit. And it's difficult while reading the book and many times not to think about current conditionings, things that have happened in just the last couple of months. So you talk a little bit about the idea that there's a reckoning with history that's needed. And this reckoning is really a realization that the reason we're in a lot of this sort of climactic problems are tied to things like our kind of capitalistic values. It's tied to exploitation of people and land. It's tied to these sort of economic and political systems that have been put in place that are the cause of much of this. And then if you tie that, and it's difficult to kind of get people to get behind that and actually come to a reckoning. But when you couple that today with Black Lives Matter, which is in a way not only acknowledging that, say, racism exists and how people are treated is occurring, it's also like an acknowledgement that it's systematic and that there are organizations in place that do that. Like, it's not just actions or racism as an individual movement. It's a systematic racism that is put in place. It's not a leftover byproduct. It's controlled. And when you do that with climate, you actually start seeing a kind of similar movement, which is these aren't just byproducts of actions. These are deep-rooted systems. And when you start to do that, you question like, well, what are your responsibilities? You know, not your responsibility by sort of pointing to a person and saying, based on your race or gender, you're to blame, but it's to say, based on your practices, things you're a part of, these things have led to it. You know, because you like to travel, because you like to go on vacation, because you like your job, or you commute, or you like expedient commerce to come to your home, that you're a part of this in the kind of climactic mechanism. And so it's interesting. I mean, I'm rambling a little bit here, but it's interesting because if you tie it to COVID, you start to realize, oh, things can change. Like, because of that, we don't have as much air travel for maybe 6 to 8 weeks, or we now have home offices. Not ideal for people with kids and various other reasons, but there change can occur. And so if I was reading, in a weird way, I guess I'm trying to say is, if I was reading this book prior last summer, I would have had one way of seeing a possible future outlined versus reading it now with the last 2 months behind us. It almost gives it's almost optimistically possible to think about what you're writing as a plausible change can occur at a kind of DNA level because of local events or global events that otherwise couldn't have been predicted or hoped for.
Yeah, I think people are pretty adaptable. I think that a lot of people too would, if they had the opportunity to change some of the things, you know, they were doing, they would take it. And it's more about, you know, how do we offer people those opportunities, whether it's in regards to mode of transport or, you know, energy provider or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of people thinking about this all the time, right? Food systems, et cetera. So just to have other choices on the table, then people can have the opportunity to act in line with what they value.
It's funny though, because I've always thought that. And then I, at the same time, have recently become a bit more pessimistic about that, because I mean, I grew up in the States. Maybe less than 2 years ago, we moved to Switzerland to be closer to my wife's family. And we live in a town, we live in Lausanne, in a country that has amazing public transportation. Occasionally, when we're not on public transportation or we're on a bus and we are, you start to see traffic and you're thinking to yourself, my God, you guys, we have everything here. We have trains that run on time, trains that run frequently. We have buses that connect all over the city. And yet somehow people still choose to get in their car to go do something. And it's this level of like ease, I guess, that is associated with it. And in some way, it feels almost like what the pandemic produced in some way is a kind of mandatory shutdown of, say, air travel or movement. And because it was a mandatory shutdown, people had no choice but to change how they worked a little bit. And then I'm being pessimistic here, but in a way, because it worked and these corporations, people who I know who work for these larger corporations now realize that they can save money because they're not opening their offices or putting electricity in the office, you know, they're actually saving money. And all of a sudden, you know, this becomes a conversation where in a way, I wonder how much I'm in a weird way, I'm trying to be optimistic here in the sense that because of such a awful world event occurred, you're seeing mandatory changes in lifestyle and realizing big moves can happen, even though, you know, when we try to do it incrementally through, say, public transportation or access to things, you know, that it didn't sort of have that same sail to it that, in an ironic way, a pandemic did.
Well, I mean, that kind of logic, though, would lead you to maybe favor an authoritarian state, right? By extension, kind of the same type of external force mandating changes. Well, I don't know. I don't know if it'll stick that well either if it's not driven by people's own desires.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And that, I guess that's why this kind of comes to this idea of how do you shift it from being always a kind of moral ethical good, but at the same time also being about some other initiative that this idea of the pull versus the push, you know, like that idea of how are we envisioning a future that people want to be a part of and make those sacrifices for, like that idea of the gifting versus the financial, like expecting somebody to gift their work and their time for a future generation that could benefit from it. I think there needs to be that element of it that is more than simply a financial return. And of course, I know I don't want an authoritarian dictator telling us what to do, but at the same time, taking opportunities while they're there and realizing that it seems like you could explain to people that because of a global shutdown, you don't need to travel to LA to have that meeting. You don't have to do X, Y, and Z for that. You know, it turns out the economy for the most part functions without that. And can those then be optimized and extended to entice other kind of big moves that otherwise wouldn't happen without an awful event like this?
Yeah, well, on the optimistic side, I think the pandemic really illustrated and is illustrating two things. One is that we have this architecture for rapidly establishing and disseminating new social norms. The other is that people really were willing to sacrifice quite a bit for other people that are more vulnerable than them. And I feel like this is kind of getting lost, especially in the US, as there's a lot of kind of anger that's being directed towards other groups in society rather than at decision makers, or non-decision makers, as the case is. I think that by and large, people have done an amazing job sacrificing so much for this. And, you know, if that could be replicated for climate change, we'd be well on our way.
That in many ways, I mean, I don't remember her name, but I was listening to NPR and there was a great conversation about, you know, climate change and it's why climate change is affecting obviously certain groups of people more than others. And it's tied to where people live within cities, where people are willing to bury and pollute within cities and within nations and regions. And this affects different groups of people differently. And so I think you talk a little bit about this idea of false hopes for maintaining the same, you know, where in a way people look at geoengineering or they look at sustainability. Those are not interchangeable words, but these sort of movements of how to do better with Earth. And it's often tied to this idea of maintaining, like, can we keep what we have now? And instead, you go on to point that in many ways, this is already a dystopic existence for a lot of people already. You know, the fact of flooding, of air pollution, of their own exploitation. And that said, that what we need is to exit the situation. You know, so it's not an idea. I think we like to paint the picture of can we maintain through action, when in reality, too many people are already living in a kind of dystopic world that are trying to get out. And so it requires in many ways, so in a way, so clearly we can't be going back. We need to be moving forward with vision for new expectations. And so I imagine that becomes a very difficult thing to explain to people, in which this idea of geoengineering or after geoengineering isn't really about maintaining anymore. It's about, that's already left. I mean, it's already left in the sense of how much we've polluted, but it's also left in terms of what the ramifications have been. It's just that I think there's that kind of William Gibson quote of that the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. I mean, I think you could reword that for the same sentiment, which is it's already too late. It's just not too late for everybody yet, but it's already there. And so how do we create new visions or new images so people realize that this isn't about maintaining, this is about kind of exiting the situation?
Yeah, exactly. I think that with solar geoengineering, that sounds and perhaps is closer to maintaining in that it could theoretically maintain global mean temperatures or stabilize the climate for long enough to make the next move. So not as an end game, but as like a kind of pause to give more time to execute whatever better world is out there. But I'm not saying that's necessarily the case. It's probably the least likely way this would be used, which is why I think it's super important that everybody engages with this topic, if they have the bandwidth to make it not this kind of indefinite stopgap where people keep making claims that it's temporary and it becomes kind of this new normal, right? There's a very bad version of solar geoengineering out there, but given the climate crisis, there's also perhaps a version in which it maintains some conditions of the climate we used to enjoy. That's a question for research. We don't even know enough about it to say whether that would or wouldn't be the case. I think for carbon removal, on the other hand, I don't see that as a maintaining because it requires so much energy to run some of these carbon removal processes when you're thinking about direct air capture or making synthetic fuels from CO2, et cetera. So that's more of a, you're going to need to scale up this huge renewable infrastructure to even power those processes in a way that they would be carbon negative. So you're assuming that there's ample supply of cheap renewables and you've had the policy in place to get all that there. So I really see that as something pretty different.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big part of this discussion. I imagine this is something you must run across when people talk about geoengineering. I imagine they see it as a term that has a singular trajectory when in reality, just as you were describing it, it has many platforms. I mean, it has a part of geoengineering is about, or at least within the book, it's a discussion of having action now to make sure we don't pollute more. It's also about multiple levels. Like as you talked about, whether it's the aerosol version of solar, it's about, yeah, maintaining. It's about reflecting. If it is about carbon sequestering, it's about removal. It's about actually taking things away. And so just in those three examples, it's about reflecting, removing, and stopping. And so do you find that when you talk about geoengineering, is that something that is often not sort of seen in it? Like, does geoengineering in a way, or a conversation about geoengineering almost need its own marketing, a remarketing, a rebranding, so people don't see it as a singular action, but realize that it's a series of disparate actions that actually are doing different things as part of a kind of soup of possibility.
Yeah, and even within a technology, there's vastly different ways of implementing it. And some of them you'd end up with the exact same social relations and inequities. And others of them could be completely transformative, like something with like bioenergy with carbon capture, for example, could be either of those things, depending on how you do it. So I definitely think we need better terminology that's more refined. People have tried to rebrand the umbrella concepts, you know, and I actually prefer the terminology that the National Academies of Sciences here in the U.S. uses, which is climate intervention, because I think it's just more accurate than geoengineering, because engineering has a kind of precision that we know we don't have. So intervention is a much more accurate term for what the verb would be, the action.
Yeah, because between I have written down here climate restoration. I mean, between climate restoration and climate innovation, I think there does seem to be this kind of interesting moment where you realize it almost requires the kind of general public to have this knowledge base increasingly to sort of be aware of such large implication and actions happening around them. And I thought one of the examples I just want to end with that I thought was really interesting, because I had never heard of it, and which had to do with enhanced weathering. And so maybe I might ask you if you could explain that a little bit, the idea of enhanced weathering for carbon capture, because what was interesting about it was not just the mechanism of it, but the fact that it seemed like a great example of something that both had a technology associated with it. It had a spatial quality, meaning it left a remnant that required something, someone had to do something with it, which in this case were these mountains. And then it had required compromise. It requires those compromises to figure out what to do with it. And I neglected to say this, and I'll come back in the introduction to say it, is that your book does something kind of interesting, which is it not only is discussing this through a nonfiction reporting and writing that you do, you have these sort of moments in the book that are fictional, that are sort of storylines that help illustrate some ramifications of plausible ramifications of what you're discussing scientifically. And one of this had to do with these mountains that are produced through enhanced weathering. Do you mind just explaining that, kind of take a stab at that, explain that to us?
Yeah, I find that enhanced weathering is maybe one of the techniques that's harder to wrap our minds around if we don't have a background in geology. But it basically refers to this question of how could you speed up the rock cycle, the way in which rocks weather, because eventually the fate of carbon is to become rock over like geologic, obviously, time scales. And so scientists are looking at different ways to speed up those reactions. So there's one technique that involves injecting into carbon dioxide into rock and having it turn to stone inside the rock. This is the CarbFix project in Iceland that's called in situ weathering. But another idea that is being researched is grinding up certain types of minerals like olivine or basalts and spreading them over fields, so that would eventually the minerals will go into the sea and weather there. Basically, just different ways to make this process happen within the order of years rather than millennia, right? So
the idea, I was going to say, because I didn't realize this until reading it. I was, you know, you talk about carbon capture, and I guess the question is always like, what does it become? Like when you capture carbon, what is it? Is it a liquid? Is it air? Is it like loose particulates? And this is just an example of when you do carbon capture, in this case, it's about actually making it into, as they say, based on what kind of finances you want to put towards it, you can actually turn it into physical rock.
Yeah, if you have the right situation. So that process, it works really well in Iceland because there's enough water to do it. It's a water intensive process and they have renewable energy too. And obviously it's better if you can turn it into rock, because then you know it's not moving around. So if you inject, like most CO2 injections, I think probably most, you know, they have to make it into this supercritical liquid and transport it through pipelines and so forth and inject it underground. And then you have to monitor it to see. It's hard to know where it might go, right? So you have to monitor it for injuries to make sure it's not moving around. But if it's rock, that's kind of has that advantage on the monitoring and liability side. So liability is a huge issue when it comes to scaling up these things.
I thought what was interesting too is, and I forget the scientist's name you were talking about. I think it was at USC in Los Angeles, University of Southern California. And I think he points to the fact that there's a big discrepancy between the numbers they kind of run in the lab and what they're seeing in reality by factors of 10 or 100 in terms of what is actually happening. And I found it really intriguing because he seemed to be one that was the most honest about it, realizing that we don't really know what happens when you do these things in the environment. I guess he refers to it as a kind of applied science, just saying that, which is another sort of interesting subset of all this conversation, which is how this much of this is funded. And a lot of it is funded through research within laboratory versus, say, what he was doing, which is applied science, is like going out and sort of executing these as projects, not so much as lab studies. And in doing so, realizing that there are big discrepancies, not only in the sense that it could be worse than they think, it actually could be better than they think. It could be absorbing a lot more than they think. And this sort of became, this is sort of something that comes up a couple times in the book, which is really the idea of like, scientists don't know what happens when you even start removing CO2, like how long it takes for change to occur. Like there's so many interesting parts of this, which is simply to say, because it's a science, it doesn't mean they have all the facts. It simply means they have intuition and know-how, but there's a lot of unknowns within this. And these aren't unknowns in the sense that something could cataclysmically go wrong. It's just simply time frames are difficult to know because they just simply haven't been executed like this.
Yeah, well, there's really interesting basic science questions about rock weathering rates and, you know, the role of microbes in the soil with all that. And those kind of things that scientists are excited about from a basic science perspective, but there hasn't been a reason up until now to do or put money into kind of applied science type questions like, can you do this at the scale of a large piece of land, which scientists are doing now. There's a group in Sheffield in the UK that's doing a lot of trials with enhanced weathering. And so we're starting to move in that direction. And there's been some government funding in other countries and especially philanthropic funding too for this, but it's just the kind of a drop compared to what is needed to answer some of the questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Holly, I said this before we started talking. I'll say it now before we end, which is I really enjoyed the book. You know, when I picked it up, it was through a recommendation that I saw online, and then through reading it, realizing, you know, this question not only of just knowing more about geoengineering and what it means, but also the fact of the kind of questions that it raises and sort of sets the kind of tone for conversation about what do we do or how are we thinking about after geoengineering, like what are our kind of goals, objectives, and responsibilities? And so I appreciate you taking the time to come on.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun.
Okay, well, take care.
You too.